court is ready to hear oral argument from petitioner in Prudential versus Financial Review. May it please the court, Mr. McConn will present argument for the petitioner. Petitioner is reserved 5 minutes to rebuttal. May it please the court, I'm Jim McConn for Prudential Insurance Company of America. Petitioner in this court and the defendant below. Prudential submits to this court that it has three separate and independent grounds upon which it can and must reverse and render the Court of Appeals decision below, which reversed and remanded the directed verdict in favor of Prudential on respondent and FRS, the plaintiff's tortious interference claims against Prudential, which is now the only cause of action remaining alive in this case. The first is that Prudential established its affirmative defense of justification against the tortious interference claim. The second is that plaintiff FRS failed to present legally sufficient evidence to support causation, a component element of this tortious interference claim. And thirdly, that FRS as an agent has no tortious interference claim under these facts. First, the justification.
Well, let me ask you, can you envision any scenario where denial of benefits, actions incident to the denial can constitute tortious interference, or are you sort of arguing an absolute sort of privilege type justification?
Justice O'Neill, the way you framed your question, incident to the investigation, analysis, and subsequent denial of the claim, I cannot. There would be no conduct within that context that would allow a contractor on late charge, lost hospital charges, to claim tortious interference.
So it would be carte blanche. They could do really anything they wanted to do, disparage, libel, whatever they wanted to. It could never come under the auspices of tortious interference.
I do not think that they could lie, but I think that for a tortious interference claim or any claim by an agent, third-party contractor such as FRS, it would have to be outside of the context of reviewing, analyzing, and subsequently denying the claim.
But when you say you don't think they could lie, isn't that a fact issue that we're, I mean, aren't they saying that Prudential did in fact lie and therefore that's the exception we're talking about here?
No, Your Honor, I don't think that they are. I mean, anything that Prudential did, and anything in this evidence is in connection with denying the claim, communicating, asking for additional information, and Prudential exercising its right and duty to deny the claim and to find it.
But if they communicated false information, I think you've just said that you couldn't lie, that would be an exception. So if an issue were that you're communicating false information, you'd say that there could be a tortious interference claim.
False information, anything that is outside the province of investigating and handling a claim.
Handling is pretty broad, so.
Your Honor, it is. I don't think there's any evidence in this case that Prudential was ever doing anything other than handling the claim. And the first ground upon which FRS claimed tortious interference was the denial of the claim. And every other kind of conduct or communication that FRS pled and tried to prove to sustain tortious interference was directly derivative of denying that claim, the communication that they had in connection with it, the extra material that they asked for, and the questions they raised about the validity.
Well, but as I heard in the answer to your question, Judge O'Neill, it sounds like you're agreeing with the Court of Appeals. You've already won on the question of there can be tortious interference in connection with the actual denial of the claim or the decision-making process associated with what Prudential was going to do with these rebilling. You've already won on that point, and no one's challenging you on that.
Correct.
What the Court of Appeals left open was the question of communications, and as I understand it, you all were relying on your right under the insurance contract to communicate with the insureds and the assinees of the insured's rights under the contract, as well as your statutory authorization to communicate with these folks, and saying that that gave you the right to communicate. And what the Court of Appeals said, as I understand it, was that, as you said, well, you can't lie. You can't. That doesn't mean you can say anything that you want and rain all over someone and damage their reputation and interfere with their contract. Now I hear you, and you've just said to Judge O'Neill, you can't lie and do those things.
There are limits.
My question is, are there limits? You've already won on the denial of the claim aspect of the tortious interference. We're over in another area in terms of your communication process, aren't we?
If we're talking about the justification defense, in this context, I think that the justification defense on the Texas beef cattle is an absolute affirmative defense that as a matter of law, that the tortious interference claim cannot be held in light of any of our motivations, what we thought about the other side, and their...
Your legal justification, as I understand it from your briefs, that you're relying upon with respect to the claims that are still alive, are relating to what you say is your right to communicate.
Ask questions, ask for additional information, yes, sir.
All with the insured and with the assignee.
Yes.
Right? Not the denial of the claim, not how you actually decide or dispose of the particular claim. So we're over in the communication area. And it's your view that right to communicate gives you the right, legally justifies Prudential to do anything it wants in connection with those communications with impunity.
Yes, it is, basically within the context of handling this claim, because if not, under these circumstances, you are allowing an agent or a third party to have a claim for insurer bad faith in the context of tortious interference.
Could Prudential be liable for business disparagement or libel or slander in connection with these communications under a different theory?
Not if it's for the conduct pled by the plaintiff in this case.
Well, you could find it too, as long as it's in connection with the claim investigation process. But wasn't there evidence that the Prudential was denying other claims that were outside the FRS auspices to try to sort of...
Your Honor, the only evidence in that regard was Wanda Morris in the hospital billing department, who said, it was hearsay to her, that she thought that there had been something pending. All she heard was that there were some pending claims. She had no direct knowledge of it.
But would you agree that if there were evidence, and there may not be, but if there were evidence such as that, would that take it out of the claims handling process of justification?
Not if it was being pended in connection with an audit, which the testimony in this case was a common occurrence.
I'm talking about, I thought there was testimony there were other claims not related to FRS, not in connection with this audit, that Prudential was holding up to put pressure on the hospital vis-a-vis FRS. If there's not such evidence, tell me, but if there is any evidence, would that take it out of just the claims handling process that you're urging as the parameters of your justification?
First of all, there is no such evidence. Last word on it was Mike Lewis, president of FRS's own memo to the hospital that he had checked into it and found that there were no other non-FRS claims pending. But secondly, to the extent that that situation arose about some kind of pin on other bills in connection with the audit, which was in connection with the submission of these late charge, lost charge claims, I would say that it's within the context of the claims handling process.
Well, and let me just ask you a quick procedural point. There was a directed verdict at the close of the plaintiff's case.
Yes.
How does that affect the fact that, I mean, don't you need to put on some evidence for your justification defense since it's an affirmative defense? Would there be a proper directed verdict?
Not at all, Your Honor, because justification defense is based on a pure matter of law, which is the first strand of the Texas v. Cattle defense, which is if a defendant is in the conduct complained of is exercising something you have a legal right to do, which in this case, Mitch not only had a right to do, but a legal statutory duty to do, that establishes the affirmative defense.
So
there is no fact testimony.
So you're saying you established it through the plaintiff's case?
And as well as bringing it up in the summary judgments prior to the case and in the arguments that were part of the motion for directed verdict.
You want us to say that as long as what your client was doing was handling the claim, then you're justified in your conduct?
As long as we were exercising our legal right and duty, which is the same thing as you just said.
Right. And what I'm curious about is, in looking at all the various ways in which an insurance company may handle a claim to decide whether or not to pay it or deny it, what you're asking us to do is to look at those facts and say, as a matter of law, those facts constitute nothing more than the claims handling process.
I think that that's part and parcel of what the trial court had to do, and which in turn he would have to do in establishing or finding that it is that we were exercising our legal right.
Here's where I'm going with this. What kind of broad way or what kind of way can we write an opinion that says, kind of a black and white legal principle standard, that as long as you do X and only X, then your conduct is confined to the claims handling process? I mean, how can we set a black and white standard that you can't go beyond?
Well, I think probably it's going to have to be a case-by-case situation of whether or not the defendant in a tortious interference case was exercising its right, as was done in Texas v. Cattle, which seemed to be a lot more difficult facts below. And as this court followed the Texas v. Cattle decision a few months after in the Calvillo decision, they affirmed the summary judgment for the defendant below, even though there was evidence clearly in the record of personal acrimony of the defendant against the plaintiff.
It's an allegation that Prudential was starting false rumors about FRS that were intended to reach HSA protected by your claims handling.
That's the same thing. I think the Court of Appeals has already, in its decision, decided that there was no evidence to support that claim.
Well,
I'm just asking,
if there were evidence, does that fall within your category of claims handling for which Prudential can act without having ever to worry about being liable of the consequences of its actions?
I think that one could easily find, depending on the circumstances, that starting false rumors would be outside of the claims process. Communications that go on that somebody forms a belief about FRS about that are within the claims process is one thing.
What about harassing HCA representatives with sham audits and unreasonable bad faith demands and pressure tactics?
That is the characterization that's been...
I understand. I'm just asking you. If we assume, I'm not asking you to concede that's what's in the record. I'm just asking you that on certain kinds of conduct so that we can test what limits you're putting on this claims handling process justification. Does that fall within or outside your justification?
I think it's within the justification, and more than that, it's something for the insured himself to complain about if he's got a first-party bad faith claim.
What if I'm an employee of HCA and I'm the person who's charged with dealing with an insurance company in terms of the hospital receiving its rights as assignee, and I'm a real bulldog about it. I'm going to really make that insurance company turn.
You're with the hospital.
I'm with the hospital. I'm an employee of the hospital. And you all don't like it because I'm pushing hard to try to make you pay things, following up on things, doing whatever. And you start using pressure tactics on my employer, telling them I'm stealing from the hospital, I'm a really bad person, whatever, to get me off of that. It's all in connection with your criticizing my handling of it. It's not true. Are you liable under any theory?
Because in response to pressure by the hospital...
I lose my job. You put pressure on the hospital about the way I'm doing my end of it, tied into the handling of the claims that we've presented to you. I lose my job. Do I just have to walk away? And you can say, gosh, we were just doing our rights, we were handling our rights with respect to the claims handling process.
So the plaintiff is a hospital employee who's complaining about the way the Prudential handled its claims handling process?
I put a lot of pressure on Prudential to make you all follow up. I find mistakes. I do all kinds of things. The result is you all have to pay more money. And you start putting pressure on my employer, telling them false things about me, so that perhaps they'll put somebody else in my position that won't look as closely. It's all claims handling, isn't it?
If it's communication outside of the nature of the claim and what they're claiming and questions and documentation for that, there's an argument that that's outside of the claims review process. That's not what we have here.
But I want to make sure I understand your test. Your test is, I mean, what you're saying is you have certain statutory and contractual rights to communicate here.
And duties.
There may be some communication that may be outside of that. And so someone has to determine whether or not what occurred here is outside of that. Isn't that right?
Outside of the claims
not
process?
Whether within your statutory or contractual duty to communicate. And isn't that what the Court of Appeals said?
The Court of Appeals said that the reason that it thought the justification defense didn't apply is because it had to be, the fact finder had to determine Prudential's good faith, and that is directly contrary to your holdings in Texas v. Cattle.
I thought it went under the second prong of Texas Cattle, which does have a good faith component in it. Didn't the Court of Appeals do that? It just didn't buy your argument that
the Court of Appeals,
there was justification as a matter of law?
The Court of Appeals would only do that if there's not a justification as a matter of law, because Prudential was exercising its right to administer this claim. It's duty to do so. You're saying if you went to the second prong?
There's a good faith component to that, isn't there?
There is.
And that's what the Court of Appeals was referring to when it talked about good faith. And in fact, the Court of Appeals even mentioned that it wasn't going to do an end run around the absence of a good faith cause of action by a third party against an insurer.
It did admit that it shouldn't be.
Let me ask a question, Mr. Cohen. See if I've got a handle on this. If FRS's complaint is that you denied a claim because you said this was a double payment, you were being double billed, in other words, Prudential was being double billed, and FRS said, well, that's disparaging me because you're indicating I'm committing a fraud by sending out a second bill that you've already paid. You would say that would be under the first prong of the beef cattle case because that is justification. You were responsible for paying a bill. You have every right to tell them I've already paid for this bill.
And the duty to communicate why you're not doing it.
Why you're not
your
doing it.
Opinion
and you'd
and
say that that is the first prong, justification. You don't have to have good faith for it. You can say that even if you just dislike FRS. That's within your prerogative. If, on the other hand, you contact the hospital and you say, I think FRS people are defrauding the hospital by making bogus claims or asserting that they've recovered certain claims and charging the hospital, but it has nothing to do with the particular bills you've been seeking out. You'd say, well, if you were going to defend that, that'd have to be under the second prong. You'd have to show that you at least had a good faith belief that you had the right to communicate that to the hospital. If that's outside, it didn't deal with any bills you received. You just said, I learned that they were doing something else out there, and they're working for the hospital. I need to tell the hospital about it. That would be under a second prong where you would have to have a good faith belief that you had the right to do that.
And that you were in the context of administering this claim. And in any event, the evidence is clear that the hospital came to its conclusions
which it did through its own devices, and moved very quickly before my time runs out through the causation issue.
Oh, I see your time,
it is.
You're answering the question.
I have a follow-up question, though. Would you please go to your third point, which is that as a matter of putting aside justification, as a matter of law, there can be no tortious interference when there is an alleged interference with an agent contract with its principal. Just summarize what the basis for your argument is there and what the main law you rely upon.
It is, Your Honor. It's this court's holdings in the Holloway versus Skinner case and the Morgan Stanley case, and I will state to begin with that there was not an agent that was the plaintiff in all of those cases, but both of those decisions of this court supported two holdings pretty established in Texas law, and they reaffirmed them. That one, that a promisee to a contract cannot sue a promisor for tortious interference on facts that are nothing more than essentially a breach of that same contract. That was Holloway. The Morgan versus Stanley, and the Morgan Stanley case stated that when there is a dispute between a party, in this case like Prudential, and an agent like FRS on a matter that is of interest to the principal, in this case the hospitals, and the hospitals are not complaining to the principal, then neither can the agent. Now, FRS responds to that by saying that what it is complaining about is not the alleged breach of the insurance contract to which Prudential was a party and the hospital was the assignee of the rights, but they cannot legitimately be heard to say that because their very first claim about what this breach is about or about what this tortious interference claim is about is the refusal to pay the claims and all the other conduct that they complain about directly followed from that.
Any other questions? Thank you, John. Court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Reed Muller will present argument for the respondent.
May it please the court, this is my first ever appearance here. In preparation, I took counsel from others who told me to be aware that this court is not just interested in the outcome of this one case, but in the meaning and effect of its rulings on all cases. And so I've thought about that some. And you perhaps already know, but it bears mention. The kind of conflict we see here, where a bill payer, a benefit provider, insurance company, an HMO, a PPO, an employee benefit plan, it finds itself in conflict over a bill for medical care, for services and goods, is of course happening thousands of times this very morning in our state. And there can be third parties adversely affected by how people conduct themselves within the boundaries of that conflict. This case happens to involve a contract billing service and an insurance company. But the next case may not. The next case, where the question is raised, are there legal standards that prescribe conduct that the bill payers, the insurance companies, or whoever, cannot engage in without being held legally liable? That's coming up. It's starting to come up already in Florida, Arkansas, and the Seventh Circuit. What happens when the insurance company, instead of not paying the bill, starts saying knowingly false things to other people about the source of the bill? The source of the bill doesn't have to be little old FRS. It could be your family doctor. For that matter, I guess it could be a lawyer wherever you have legal insurance. It could be anybody. And if they start saying, remember the standard I have to meet under the law of tortious interference is deliberate. If they start deliberately saying knowingly false things to third parties, calculate to hurt. Could be a physician's relationship with his patient.
You're saying the third parties, people who are strangers to the insurance agreement, or who do you identify as the third party?
Whoever it is whose business or contractual relationship with the billing source is affected. In other words, they're third party to the lawsuit, the tortious interference lawsuit.
In the facts of this case, we have a patient who has an insurance policy that agrees to reimburse the patient for the patient's medical expenses to a certain period. The patient goes to a hospital and assigns that right to that reimbursement to the hospital. The hospital, through that assignment, direct bills to Prudential. The hospital then hires its own agent to come in and represent it in collecting those bills. And
or employ someone.
In this three-way transaction, are any of those the third party you're referring to?
If the source of the bill loses a relationship with somebody else as a consequence of what the bill payor does, then they become the third party to the destruction of the relationship.
In this case,
I don't think I've answered that very clearly.
You said your comment was a communication to a third party, and by the false communication to a third party, and I was just trying to identify who you understood to be third party.
In this case, the hospital, but in the next case, it could be a patient.
Okay. In your view, the hospital is a third party in this series of transactions.
Yes.
It's a third party to its agent's communication with the insurance company.
And vice versa. And the insurance company's communications back, which is really what the case is about. What the insurance company did, not so much what we did.
Is there any evidence, and your evidence focuses on that, your evidence focuses on the false communication was made to the hospital, and that's your identification of the third party.
They went to our customer and did things calculated to harm the customer's relationship with us, our relationship with it, in fulfillment of what we were expressly told is they'd like to see us put out of business. That's in the record.
Did they have a contractual or statutory right to do that? If they did, could they go ahead and they could communicate to your customer to try to harm you?
They have a right, I can see, to communicate with their insurers. Sure. They have a duty, as my friend Mr. McConnell pointed out, to investigate claims.
Sure.
But if they're investigating the claim and this causes them to drive down the highway to get to the hospital, and on the way there, in the course of investigating the claim, they run over somebody's child, they're not immune. They may have been discharging a duty that they owed to their insured by traveling to the hospital.
But isn't the point under that analogy that whatever the cause of action is that exists, it's not a tortious interference claim, it's a negligence claim by the third party that was harmed?
If what they do is negligence, then the claim is negligence. If what they do, at the same time that they're handling the bills, what has been argued here this morning is as long as it has some connection with handling the bills. If what they do is murder, then it's murder.
Why are you suing for libel?
Well,
I'm sorry.
I suppose I might have, but some of the things they did were not libel. For example, I have to disagree with my colleague at the bar here who said that the only evidence with regard to holding up payment of other bills unrelated to us, just other big hospitals, was that Ms. Morris heard about it. That's not true. Ms. Morris testified that she was the one that followed up on it to find out what was going on. And Mr. Michael Johnston, the attorney who at one time represented both the hospital and the FRS, also inquired into the matter and gave direct testimony at trial how he learned about it. That's not claims handling. They may say here today that that's part of the process of dealing with the bills, but please, I mean, that can't be. To say, I've got a problem with FRS's late charge bills, I'm going to slow pay you $100,000 bills unrelated to all this, and when the hospital calls to find out why, what's holding up these bills? They finger us.
Mr. McCon has directed our attention to an issue in the case regarding whether there should be a cause of action for tortious interference when the contract is alleged to be interfered with between an agent and a principal. We do have an agent-principal relationship here, is that correct?
None of the cases he cited are cases of that sort. When you start trying to diagram the position of the parties in the cases, it gets kind of complicated from case to case. I tried to do that in my brief. I think he concedes I'm right about one thing. None of those cases was the plaintiff the agent. It's really a parlay of other principles.
Well, are there ramifications, though, for recognizing tortious interference in the context of a relationship between a principal and an agent that should be of concern?
Well, if you're a lawyer, the quintessential agent, and you don't want your client relationships tortiously interfered with by others, then yes, you should be concerned about this case. If you're an employee, to use the example Your Honor used earlier today, but if you're an employee, and therefore an agent of a principal, and you're concerned about somebody spoiling your relationship with your employer, then yes, you should be concerned about this case.
Is it of any import that the two contracts at issue here, the set of insurance contracts that Prudential had with its insurers assigned to the hospital, and the separate contract between FRS and HCA, and I don't know how to exactly articulate this, are in some way connected? They flow from each other. Obviously, FRS would not be here collecting bills or whatever, but for the original insurance contract Prudential had with the insurers. Is that of any import in this analysis?
Well, I'm not stalling to answer the question, but remember, FRS and Prudential was not just a direct insurer of some of these patients. For some of them, it was simply rendering an administrative service for somebody else to handle to process the claims. So in those cases, which are numerous, I don't know if the record gives you a tabulation of them, but it's conceded there were many of them that were like that. FRS has no contract with these insurers. I mean, Prudential has no contract with these insurers. They're just somebody they're administering bills for.
What about the circumstances involving the contract that Prudential did have with the insurers that then came under review as a result of FRS's contract with HCA?
Strictly speaking, that's not what happened.
Okay.
The question was whether Prudential would permit the bills, the FRS bills, to be put through for routine processing and payment. Some patients may not have met their deductible, some items may not have been covered under their plan. That stage was never gotten to. The record abundantly shows that for these hospitals and every other hospital on earth, Prudential never pays, at least not knowingly, a dime on any FRS bill. It doesn't matter what the bill's for. It doesn't matter what hospital it's from. What the terms of the individual contracts for the individual patients may be doesn't matter. Prudential pays no FRS bills ever.
Well, let me ask you a question, though. They don't owe FRS anything. They owe the hospital something, maybe.
Correct.
And the hospital hired FRS as its agent to collect those bills.
Correct.
And your complaint is that Prudential went to the hospital and told them their agent, they're not going to pay these bills, and they're going to, they have no interest in doing business with this agent, and on top of that, the agent's lying, and the hospital fires the agent. And that is tortious interference with the agent's contract with the hospital.
The non-payment of the bills is not, in this case, for two reasons, really. One is the decision of the Court of Appeals, which we've elected not to challenge here. The second reason is the non-payment of the bills is what they do to us everywhere on earth. We didn't lose all of our customers. We lost the one set of customers that was targeted by all this other behavior. The behavior that they now urge should be immune. I mean, listen to the way Mr. McConnell has presented. He's not talking about the defense of justification. He's talking about an absolute immunity covering what you do.
What I said is they told the hospital they weren't going to pay bills that FRS was dealing with, and they told the hospital that FRS was lying.
Yes, that's right. They accused us of a variety of things.
And so the hospital fired the agent it had hired to collect these bills.
Right.
And you say that that Prudential Bank, having gone to its contracting party to complain about the way the contracting party was farming this out, complaining about the person to whom they had farmed it out.
Prudential's not a contracting party with the hospital. They're a contracting party with the patients.
Well, by assignment, they're a contract. They permit the assignment to the hospital.
Yes.
So aren't they a contract? Well,
the benefit of the contract is assigned. They're formally actually called an assignment of benefits.
But then is it critical to your argument that the hospital is not a contracting party with Prudential?
I don't think it is critical to my argument, but of course I'm sensitive to it because it's embedded in your question, and I want to be able to answer your question.
Well, in your view, it is tortious interference with the agent's contract from the principal if the principal's contracting party complains about the agent.
Depends on the individual case. Depends on what their behavior is. It depends upon what's calculated to do.
Well, their behavior is you're not going to pay any bills that are submitted by the agent, and they're telling the hospital that the agent's a liar.
I can imagine a case where that would do with it if they deliberately and falsely said they're lying. I mean, picture yourself as the doctor who is accused of billing for not medically necessary items. Sounds like bland language until it's directed at you. That makes people's blood boil. That a doctor is rigging up his bills while charging for not medically necessary things.
But regarding tortious interference, if you concede that if they say, we're not going to pay any bills that come through your agent, that's not tortious interference.
In this case, my claim for tortious interference cannot rest on that.
How is saying, we're not going to pay the bills because he's a sleazebag, any different?
Because accusing us of being a sleazebag is calculated to cause our contracting party to fire us.
Well, not get the money might cause them to fire us.
They didn't.
If they say, well, we're never going to get our money, maybe we ought to get somebody else to process these claims.
Well, they got millions of dollars because most of the other carriers pay our bills. Well, a few of them sometimes audit it, but after the audits, they pay the bill. The distinction is not that Prudential didn't pay the bill. Prudential doesn't pay the bills of the other hospitals. They haven't fired us. Prudential didn't pay the bills here. Nothing bad happened. What happened was the usual rise and fall of patient complaints when the mailings go out rose and never fell again. It just continued on.
Well, Prudential had the right to communicate with their patients, didn't they?
Yes.
Some of our holdings, they may have had liability on the first-party bad faith insurance law if they didn't continue to communicate.
Over and over again?
Yes.
Over and over again.
Under some of our holdings, isn't that correct?
Without limitation as the number or content.
As long as the claim is open, we've intimated at least you have to keep the lines of communication.
Well, I don't believe just continually pricking the patients with a communication that says nothing new whatsoever, after you've already met whatever statutory obligations you were under, just to keep the patients angry at a hospital, meets that. And on this point, let me say, although their brief asserts that these communications they sent to the patients, I'm turning now from the communications to the hospital to the communications to the patients, the brief says that they were done within these certain statutory time frames because they had to and so forth, and I'm telling you, there's no evidence of that. But this all started, so far as you can tell from this record, it all started when they started gathering up a box of our bills long after they'd been sent, long after they'd sent their memo internally that's in evidence and said, don't pay these bills. Here, don't pay them. I mean, they'd made a final decision not to ever pay our bills long before this controversy came around. What they didn't do was write the patients the letter, timely, that they needed to say we're not paying this bill. Instead, they went on this whole other campaign. That's what the case is about. It's not about we sent somebody a letter that said we're not paying a bill. That happens every day.
Well, let's say that the facts show they, in bad faith, denied the claim. Absolutely bad faith, motivated by all bad intentions. And we have held that there is no third-party action for bad faith denial of claim. How do we bootstrap the tortious interference argument? How do we reconcile that with our case law that says there can't be a third-party action for bad faith? Because arguably, the same factors are going to apply to both. And how do you differentiate between them?
Well, of course, you don't bootstrap it, I respectfully submit. What you do is treat different cases differently and like cases alike. And what's different about this case from the ordinary we didn't pay the bill is all these other forms of behavior they engaged in. They come out, they audit the bills. They know that there's medical records supporting each item on the bill. Then they go meet face to face with the hospital administrator.
But all that would support a bad faith claim. No question about it. The hospital could bring, or the patient could bring, a bad faith claim for denial of benefits. And we have said that a third party can't sue for bad faith denial of benefits to the insurer.
And I'm not.
And how are we just rewording the cause of action? Because we do have evidence of bad faith, and it seems like that's what we'd be allowing here. In other words, there is a certain blending of the two. And how would we draw a bright line test to differentiate between what constitutes tortious interference and what is a third party trying to collect on a bad faith denial?
The denial of the claim, in good faith or bad faith, is not what the Court of Appeals opinion would allow to be tried. They sustained the lower court's ruling on one of the five grounds of interference that we allege. So we never have to be worried about non-payment of the claim, whether it's done in bad faith or good faith or any faith, carelessly or deliberately. We don't have to worry about that ever, under the law of this case, becoming
grounds for tortious interference.
But what you're suing to recover is the amount of that claim.
Oh, absolutely not. Absolutely not.
How are you
the damages evidence at trial reflected the true fact that Prudential never pays our bills. We're not suing for that money. What we lost was the contract that allowed us to bill people generally, not just Prudential, but Aetna, employers, and so forth, and they pay our bills. Not anymore at these hospitals, though, because we lost that contractual relationship.
So your distinction then would be that you're not suing, I think that your opposing counsel is saying that because you're suing to recover the benefits, what you're trying to do is bootstrap a bad faith claim. But you're saying you're not suing to recover those amounts.
Correct.
You're suing for damages related to losing business out of other accounts. That would be the distinction.
Yeah, that's one, yeah, absolutely. In other words, when you try to calculate what our revenue was before and after we got fired, our revenue before we're fired is not $1 from Prudential. They don't pay our bills.
Well, I'm still having trouble here because you say if they don't pay the bill and they say we're not paying this bill because we don't like FRS,
we're not going to pay some other bills over here, big ones. If you add all that up, I mean, that constellation of behavior.
And we want you to do away with that department and stop billing us.
Yeah. And if it causes somebody that had just finished offering our principal, Ms. Capella, a job, to turn right around and fire the whole company,
I understood Mr. McCann said that there was absolutely no evidence that they had held up other bills.
He is deeply mistaken in that regard. Wanda Morris and Mike Johnston testified that they did. The Court of Appeals recited evidence in opinion, and the record references are in my brief. They did. They positively did, and she called and found out that, they said, well, it's because of the FRS situation. And these are not FRS bills. I mean, it was terrible. Nobody should treat people that way. Any other questions? Thank you very much. Henry Bowe, I would submit to the court that there is no evidence that Prudential sent continued letters. Every letter that Prudential sent on this record was in response to a late charge claim to a particular insured. There's also no evidence on this record that Prudential never paid an FRS bill. They paid many FRS bills. Diamond was under the audit screen until they did the audit and discovered what they discovered and expressed their reasons for not paying.
Could you respond to your opponent's argument about the damages and the effect on your position that there should be no tortious interference for a contract between a principal and an agent? He identified the fact that the damages were not that Prudential didn't pay these claims, but that they lost their contract with HCA, which meant they lost their income as a result of all these other relationships that the hospital had with other insurance companies and so on.
It's still based on...
It sounds like we're getting outside that two contract dichotomy you were talking about.
I can only say that I disagree because it all arises out of the claim that not paying the bills and everything they did in connection therewith.
What if the damages flow from something else other than Prudential's refusal or failure or decision not to pay claims? What if there are other damages totally unrelated to anything that is related to a Prudential insurance contract? Does that make a difference?
It could. In this case, it arose out of the hospitals themselves deciding that they didn't want the problems that this FRS billings produced inherently.
But what difference would that make in your legal analysis?
In this particular case, because of the setting of an insurance claim, just that very setting, to allow that, in this case, to make a difference is doing nothing more than letting every breach of contract with his commission involved be a tortious interference claim. It's also letting bad faith insurer claim be a tortious interference claim.
Well, maybe I'm not stating my question right. I understood what we just heard about damages. The point was, I'm not claiming that Prudential didn't pay claims and therefore I didn't get my commission. I'm claiming that as a result of Prudential's contract, I lost my contract with the hospital, which would have allowed me to earn commissions based on collecting from all these other insurance carriers unrelated to Prudential. How does that fit with your analysis, and does it take it outside this bad faith claims handling context that you've been talking about?
I think you get back to the propositions in Holloway and Morgan Stanley that it all arose out of that, and the hospital, the principal was not complaining about it, so why can the agent? If I heard Mr. Reed Miller right, I think he's questioned Prudential's right or duty to communicate with the hospital as a opposed to just the insureds, as if the hospital was some kind of stranger to the FRS contract. Of course it was not. It was the S&E who had the right to the proceeds if they were otherwise payable. I think the most telling evidence about justification and causation in this case is the very nature of FRS's business. It sends out hospital bills a year or two after they've already been paid, claiming that they were lost or somehow not collected in the first place. It inherently raises questions. FRS's brief has a heading for serious problems, where they say they try to address it by spreading out the bills for the questions and complaint calls that they're going to get from patients and doctors. And most of them, they don't even send a copy to the insured, which is required under the policy, so that they can keep the level of discontent down. And that said, FRS cannot come before this or any court and say that what Prudential did in questioning those bills was not justified, and moreover, and as importantly, can't say that the exact reasons, that the only evidence in this record about why the people who made the decisions to terminate FRS was not because of Prudential. It was because of the patient, in addition to not making its right to charge them.
Did call us to make an evidence? Call upon us to weigh the evidence to make that call? Isn't that disputed? You're asking us to find that as a matter of law.
I think I'm trying to underscore why the justification defense applies to something like this, as well as their arguments on causation are not well-founded, because they are admitting that their business is inherently questionable what they do. It raises problems that create, that underscore the justification defense, as well as their arguments on lack of causation. Did I answer your question?
Yeah.
Well,
thank you very much.